Good afternoon, everyone. Some people have sun in their eyes, so feel free to shift your position if you like. Or just enjoy the sun in your eyes. We've been exploring the Brahmaviharas, those states of being, those states of heart and mind, which the Buddha talked about as the awakened emotions, the qualities of heart of an awakened being. Or an awakening one. We're all awakening beings. And so we're cultivating these qualities of heart and mind. And we've talked about loving kindness, metta, friendship, care, goodwill. And we've also talked about compassion. Did a compassion practice last night. And I'd like to talk about equanimity today. Equanimity is one of these four. It's a word that we don't hear very often outside of this practice. It's a little bit of an unusual or old-fashioned word. So Andy Olinsky, who is a former director of the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, is now a professor at Lesley University, I think, in Buddhist Studies. And he said that it's one of the most difficult Buddhist ideas to explain, even more than the idea of not self, which is difficult enough. But he says it's challenging because how is it that one can neither like or not like something without being emotionally detached or indifferent? It seems that if we're not preferring one thing or another, that, yeah, we must be somehow disconnected. And that's because our sense of identity is so bound up with our desires and our preferences. So it just seems to people that, you know, that's what makes us human, is that we have preferences. Is that we, you know, we like things, we go towards certain things and go away from others. And it's natural, it's human to like certain things and to not like other things. It just arises with the feeling tone of, you know, pleasant, not pleasant, or kind of neutral. But when we define ourselves in terms of these preferences, and when we attach ourselves so strongly to these preferences, and that's, you know, how we kind of develop and construct the sense of self, that makes it so difficult to unravel. And Andy says, fortunately, there's a relatively easy and accessible way to counter the powerful forces of desire, the cultivation of equanimity. And every moment of mindfulness is also a moment of equanimity. Because, you know, we've been talking about mindfulness and how, you know, in that moment of being mindful with whatever our experience is, whether it's something internal, a feeling, an emotion, a thought, you know, when we're mindful of that, we're not grasping it or pushing away from it. We're not identifying with it as me or mine. And that is the quality of equanimity. And so as we cultivate moment by moment this capacity to be with our experience, to be present with our experience, with an open heart, with acceptance, without reactivity, we are cultivating equanimity. Engaging with the breath, with a feeling tone or thought, without wanting it to stay as it is or to be different from what it is. Gil Fronsdale, who is a teacher at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California, is a very wonderful scholar and meditation teacher, and he's a translator, and he translates. He says that there are two separate Pali words which are used to translate the word equanimity, which, you know, give this sense of equanimity, and they have a different nuance. So the most common Pali word translated as equanimity is upekkha. So if you're familiar with the teachings on the four Brahma Viharas, it's metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. So metta, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And the sense of upekkha in Pali is the sense of to look over. So it refers to the quality of equanimity that comes from the power of observation, the ability to see without being caught by what we see. So even feeling deeply about our experience, trusting that we can host these emotions. So, you know, we may feel sad, we may feel joy, we may feel concerned. And at the same time, we don't lose our sense of balance. We don't get caught up in a story, in a sense of identity, in a drama, which then overtakes the mind and consumes us. So when equanimity is present, so it's that quality of non-reactivity. And so this is not to judge ourselves. When we do get caught in the story, in the drama, sometimes these stories and dramas can be very compelling, and, you know, events, circumstances can be very hurtful or cause a lot of grief. So simply, knowing that we are in a moment, at any moment, getting caught up and in a way being consumed by these emotions can be a kind of an orientation toward giving more space to it. So it's a kind of a bearing witness. And this equanimity, this capacity of looking over, of being able to witness and observe, comes from the moment-by-moment practice of mindfulness and seeing the arising and manifesting and passing away of every experience, of the breath, of the thoughts, of the feeling tones, of emotional states, the coming and going of the circumstances in our lives, the coming and going of events. So it's a kind of perspective. It's a seeing a bigger picture. Sometimes this capacity of mind to witness without getting caught up in is talked about as perspective, and it's a metaphor that's used is the love of a grandparent, grandmother, or grandfather might have for their grandchildren. Because it's different being a grandparent. Some of you have talked about being a grandparent, and you're just not so caught up in the drama of the day-to-day, of getting the homework done, of getting the room clean, of getting the household responsibilities taken care of. You have that perspective, like, okay, so we got through this phase of, growing up, and now they're my children, our parents, and I can be kind of, a bit of a safe haven. I can have a bit of perspective. I can say, it's probably going to work out okay. You don't have to get caught up so much. Maybe we can be a support to not only our grandchildren, but to our children, if they will let us. And there's another Pali word that's sometimes translated as equanimity, and I always stumble over the pronunciation of this, is tatra majatata, or tatra majatata. I'm not sure where the accent should be, but it's a compound word, and it's a simple Pali words. So tatra, and this is still from Gil Fronsdale, tatra meaning there, and it sometimes refers to as all these things, so all these things. And maja means middle, and tata means to stand or to pose. So put together, the word becomes to stand in the middle of all this. And I always put in my thoughts, to stand in the middle of all this mess. That we can feel like, our families are, or life circumstances are, or our work life is, or the world is, to stand in the middle of all this, and to somehow stay balanced. To stand implies balance, centered. And the balance comes from a sense of inner strength or stability. And that that stability, Bhikkhu Anelio uses the word equipoise in some context to translate the Pali. And that equipoise or balance or inner strength comes from a sense of calm, well-being, confidence, or integrity. It can keep us upright and like a ballast. And as inner strength develops, equanimity follows. And I think that we discover, we see the development of equanimity in our lives in when we have the capacity to be non-reactive in the circumstances of our lives. Like something happens, and instead of, you know, getting caught up, feeling frightened or angry, that somehow from somewhere we feel, okay, this is how it is right now. This is what's happening. And take a breath and just be present with it all. So I have a little story to share. That something that happened last night. While I was sleeping, it was about 12:30, and I suddenly felt, as I was woken up, I felt some little cold feet running across my face. Little rubbery kind of feet. And like, I woke up, turned on the light, and I immediately thought that maybe it was a mouse. And so I just noticed how I was, and that I was actually calm. And I was thinking, well, it's a mouse. You know, I hope it's not a rat. But, you know, people live in the country, and there are mice in the house, and it's not going to hurt me. Probably pretty frightened now that I've turned the light on and sat up. So I thought, well, maybe I'll there are two lamps in my room, so maybe I'll keep the other lamp on, and maybe it'll just, you know, stay. And I would try to go back to sleep. I have a sleeping mask. And so I lay down again, and I was kind of falling off to sleep. And then I hear little scurrying feet, and I hear some papers that I had piled up on the bureau go skittering down on the floor. And so I turn on the light, and I get out of bed, and I put on my glasses, and I look around. I saw this little shape, kind of, you know, there are curtains just like these in the room, and I saw this shape go skittering up, and I look, and there, peering over the tops of the curtains, is this little chipmunk face. And I'm observing myself at the same time as I'm observing everything that's happening. And I'm noticing that I love chipmunks. I feel a lot of fondness for this chipmunk. It's like, oh, sweet one, you got yourself in a situation here. And it's just gazing at me. Like, it has this just gaze. It's holding my gaze, like, and it begins to just a little thing like this. Like chipmunk little movements. And I just think, well, there's no way I look at the garbage can and I think, could I catch him and put him outside? No way. No way he's going to let me approach him and put him in that can and cover it and carry him outside. So then I thought, oh, maybe I'll just take the screen off the window. So I took the screen and I opened the window. And sure enough, in a few minutes, he went outside. But I was really noticing in that time, like, oh, you know, like, and the thoughts were coming. Yeah, people, there's a lot of fear associated with mice but I'm not feeling fear. I'm feeling like, okay, what should I do next? you know, what would be best for my sleep and for this little creature. And anyway, so we worked it out. So I knew I needed to tell that story. But it was interesting to me to notice the non-reactivity in the mind. And I was grateful for my practice. And that, you know, that because there was, you know, a fair degree of equanimity about it, that kindness was accessible as well. You know, that I didn't feel ill will toward this creature. And so that also, well, I noticed that. Oh, that's, that I was glad. That made me glad.
Carol, do you know where the nearest Holiday Inn is?
It wasn't a mouse, and he's gone. He went outside, so I don't think he'll come back.
They are never alone. They are family. I hope we will be as equanimous as you tonight.
Wish well to all beings, far and near, large and small. So, So equanimity, that balance of mind, you know, I began to notice it in myself, arising when I was on retreat. And particularly when I was on 3-month retreat and the mind became very stable and balanced. And I wondered about it because I hadn't ever experienced a mind so balanced before. So the Buddha talks about the mind of equanimity as being unshakable, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And I can't say that my mind was continuously like that, but I was noticing the development of a quality of mind that was very, very balanced and non-reactive. And I began to wonder, am I becoming a stone Buddha? And then I had to inquire into the quality of this mind and notice that on the contrary, not only was this mind not kind of indifferent and mind and heart, because they're talked about qualities of heart, mind. Not only was it not indifferent, but there was so much warmth that I was feeling as I would walk out in the woods and on the country roads and to all the little life forms around me and noticing the people and really feeling so connected. So this mind develops through seeing deeply into the rising and falling of all experience, into impermanence, anicca, and the unreliability of the world of the senses, and anatta, the contingent existence of everything. That you know, as we've been exploring in our contemplation of the five elements, the way that the earth, water, fire, air, and space are within us and outside of us and both permeating everything. So another scholar, a bhikkhu from the I don't think he's alive anymore, but he was, again, a scholar and a meditator, and he's done a lot of the translations of the Pali Canon, which we use. His name is Nyaponika Thera, and he says, looking into life, we notice how it continually moves between contrasts. Rise and fall, success and failure, loss and gain, honor and blame. We feel how our heart responds to all this with happiness and sorrow, delight and despair, disappointment and satisfaction, hope and fear. These waves of emotion carry us up and fling us down. And no sooner do we find rest than we are in the power of a new wave again. How can we expect to get a footing on the crest of the waves? These are the eight vicissitudes of life that the Buddha spoke about: happiness and suffering, fame and insignificance, praise and blame, gain and loss. So I had a poem that I wanted to read at this moment, and I didn't bring the book. I forgot to bring the book. So I'll just tell the story of the poem. And it's called Moments of Darkness. And it's the narrative of a mother in which she's making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for her daughter to take to school. And she packs her daughter's lunch, and trusting in the orderliness of life, trusting that her daughter will sit down on the steps of the schoolyard or wherever she will in the sunlight, eat her sandwich and experience a sense of being fed and well-being. And at the same time, she can visualize her daughter sitting there and visualize the hands that are holding the sandwich are empty space. So she sees both the beingness and the non-beingness of her daughter at the same time. And I'll bring the poem and read it later, because it's quite lovely. But, you know, there's a teaching, like imagine as you're walking down the street, as you imagine as you sit in a room, that every person that you see now will die, will be gone, that everything arises and passes away, that we ourselves, our life which is so full, our life which is has such intensity, you know, that life will slip away. And what will remain, that sense of that space of mind, that knowing quality which is not connected to the senses which rise and fall, sense consciousness which rises and falls through sense experience. It's that which the Buddha called the deathless, that which he called the unborn. And in the contemplation of space, in the contemplation of equanimity, of that sense of witnessing of what rises and falls manifests and passes away, we begin to orient our attention to that quality of mind which doesn't die and which is never born. As the Brahma Viharas are cultivated in our practice, that quality of kindness, of joy, of warmth of heart, friendliness, and compassion, caring about the pain, the suffering of ourselves and others, and mudita, the resonant joy, the empathetic joy in which we can rejoice for our own happiness and rejoice in the happiness of others. It's equanimity that keeps these in balance. So it's equanimity that keeps metta from becoming, you know, kind of this attachment, like, oh, I love you so much and I want you to be happy and, you know, I really, really, really want you to be happy. And if you're not happy, if you're caught in addiction, if you're, you know, then that I get lost, I lose my balance. It's that quality of metta infused with upekkha that keeps us able to love, to deeply love and care without feeling that, you know, somehow we have to control or that that happiness depends on us. You know, just to wish to give, to serve with friendship without the attachment of it has to be this way. And the same with compassion. It's it endows upekkha endows compassion with courage. The courage, I think compassion toward ourselves first of all, that quality of being able to stand in the fire of the suffering, which is we're present with, that equanimity gives us that courage to stand in that fire and to care without turning away, without distracting ourselves, without going into addiction. And it gives us that capacity to be present with the pain, the suffering of others, of the world, knowing that it's not in our capacity to, nor is it are we called to fix the suffering of another, but we can be present, we can care, we can listen, we can receive, we can support. So that kind of stability, that kind of upliftment comes from equanimity. We can see a bigger picture. We see what we can do and what we can't do. And we can also remember that we can never know the whole picture. We can never know, you know, what that person's suffering will open up for them, how that will unfold for them, and what kinds of resilience and wisdom may come about because they were able to turn toward that difficulty in their lives and meet it and learn from it and grow through it. And it's the place, as Sharon Salzberg says, it's the place where we remember, well, maybe right now I'm just planting a seed and I can't actually know what the ultimate result will be. I can just rejoice in the giving, in the planting, and feel good about that. In the holding, in the presence, and being there, and not turning away. And also, sympathetic joy, empathetic joy, resonant joy. So when we have this quality of equanimity, when that's cultivated in us, when it's developed in us, you know, we find that we can take joy not only in the success of our family and the joy of our family, our circle, our tribe, whoever that might be, but take joy in the happiness of people we don't know, people who beings, not just human beings, just the joy of a bird in flight, the joy of a dolphin playing in the water. My son has a boat, and we've gone out on the boats, and it's just such joy to see, you know, dolphins playing, and just the sheer joy of being together and leaping in the beauty of movement of the body. To allow the heart to resonate with that joy. So that our this resonance goes beyond just our little circle. I think it's also important to mention that that equanimity, I think, is what makes a dharmic engagement in the world unique and different from social activism, which is fueled by anger. Some of you might have been involved in activism, whether it's like ecological activism or anti-racism or injustice, exploitation, anti-poverty work, work in prisons. There are so many different ways to engage in the world. And it can come from a sense of service, and it can also come from a sense of a deep anger at the injustice of so much of what we see around us, an anger, you know, has this quality of being like a fire. And I know that anger is, you know, can be helpful and can be appropriate in some circumstances, but when we let it continue to fuel us, I think we are in danger of burning out. And so finding other ways to fuel our engagement with a wounded world, a world that is painful, in pain, a world that is needing the attention that we can bring to the problems, the injustices, the ingrained biases that we see around us, the habits of consumerism and so on. can we engage, can we respond from a place in which we are standing in the middle of all this mess, standing in the middle with some sense of balance, some sense of equipoise, some recognition that this is very real and very felt, and also there is a quality of ephemerality to everything in our lives, everything that arises and passes away. It's that emptiness that infuses everything. And seeing this, seeing with the eyes of wisdom, seeing with the heart of a Buddha, responding with the heart of a Buddha, I think helps us to stay balanced and to also see that shining quality in everything. The quality, you know, sometimes called suchness or thusness, that everything is alive, everything is sacred, and everything is arising and passing, ephemeral. So holding these, finding the balance of living fully and knowing also the transience of our lives is that, I think, living with the heart of the Buddha, with the heart of a Buddha, that Buddha that's alive and emerging in each one of us. So let's just sit and breathe together for a minute. Offering the quality of loving friendship, the quality of a heart of compassion that resonates with the suffering of the world, a heart of joy that rejoices in the well-being and beauty of the world around us, and a heart of balance and perspective that sees all the beauty, all the shimmering life around us manifesting and passing away. With an unshakable kindness. So this poem is called Lessons from Darkness. And it's by Anita Barrows. Everything you love will perish. Try saying this to yourself at breakfast, watching the amber-colored tea swirl in the teapot. Try it on the tree, the clouds, the dog asleep under the table, the sparrow taking a bath in the neighbor's gutter. A magician's act, presto. On a morning you feel open enough to embrace it, imagine it gone. Then, pack the child's lunch, smooth the thick peanut butter, the jeweled raspberry preserves over the bread. Tell yourself the world must go on forever. This is why you feed her, imagining the day, orderly, unfolding, imagining what you teach her is true, is something she will use. This is why later you will go out into the garden among the calendula, rosemary, hibiscus. Run your finger along the trunk of hawthorn as though it were the body of a lover, thinking of the child on the steps of the schoolyard eating her sandwich, thinking nothing, transparent air where her hands are.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.